supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. $227 million. That record personal injury settlement must now be divvied up among the plaintiffs who sued the Salvation Army and others in a Center City building collapse into a busy thrift store in 2013. WHYY's Aaron Moselle looked into how it's decided who receives what.
There are 19 plaintiffs in the case. Seven people died after an unsupported wall of a building being demolished crushed the Salvation Army thrift store at 22nd and Market Streets. 12 more were injured. Veteran personal injury lawyer Harry Kane says the settlement will be split based on arguments similar to the ones made to jurors during the damages phase of the civil trial.
They'll talk about past pain and suffering, past inability to enjoy life's pleasures, past economic loss in terms of wage loss, past economic loss in terms of medical bills.
As well as future pain and suffering, future inability to enjoy life's pleasures, future economic losses. Somewhat counterintuitively, Kane says injured plaintiffs could end up with more money than the families of those who died in the collapse.
Someone who has died has a fixed period of pain and suffering. If they were killed on the day of the accident, they only suffered for a number of hours, consciously suffered, physically suffered. But if you have someone who's catastrophically injured and remains alive, well, they've suffered every day from the date of that building collapse through the day of this settlement, and presumably will suffer every day for the rest of their expected life, and they will need care.
One of the case's plaintiffs was trapped in the rubble for 13 hours. Both of her legs were amputated at the hip. It's unclear how much of the $227 million each of the case's six defendants will pay. Those figures are sealed by a confidentiality agreement. The case's arbitrator says some of the cash will probably be covered by insurance policies. The private allocation process could start as early as the end of the month. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
New research is looking into how deportation and immigration enforcement actions affect people's health. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman has more.
Researchers at the University of Michigan wanted to follow up on studies that have linked stepped-up immigration enforcement to physical and mental health problems for undocumented immigrants and Latinos. They concentrated on one major event. At the time, it was the largest raid in U.S. history at a kosher meatpacking plant in Postville, Iowa.
900 immigration agents came to a town of 2,000 people. They arrested 389 workers at a meat processing plant.
That's lead researcher Nicole Novak. Afterward, researchers saw that a higher proportion of infants in that area born to Latina mothers had low birth rates. To be sure there was a connection, they adjusted for other factors that might have affected their risk of having a low birth weight baby. But white mothers in the state did not see an increase in such problems. Novak says past studies have shown that stress affects an infant's growth in utero. She hypothesizes these moms were under so much stress that it showed up in their babies. As the immigration debate has grown more heated nationwide, there's been talk of defunding sanctuary cities like Philadelphia. Dr. Jack Ludmere, an OBGYN who co-founded Philadelphia's Puentes de Salud, says patients locally have noticed.
There is no question that women are a concern. People are incredibly scared.
Ludmere says for him, prenatal care is not just about measuring a pregnant woman's belly or checking her blood pressure.
It is more to have a relationship and to make them feel, at least for the 5 minutes that they spend with us, that we're supporting them.
His patients, however, are not under the same intense stress as witnessed in this study. The researchers say social supports from friends and family, as well as medical providers, can soften the effects of intense stress. Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
Amazon plans to hire 100,000 people in the next year and a half, with 2,500 of them in New Jersey. These are not minimum wage jobs, but WHYY's Jeanette Beebe reports the pace of work can be very demanding.
As a business, shipping is like real estate. Location is everything. That's why Amazon has 8 fulfillment centers in Pennsylvania and 7 in New Jersey to deliver to your door as quickly as possible. But John Carr, a spokesman for the Machinist Union, says the fast, free shipping from Amazon comes at a cost.
Their performance standards are very, very high. And when you meet one, they tend to raise it. they raise that speed and standard of how many orders you can pick and pull and packet that in a certain amount of time. And Amazon tracks that. I think a lot of these workers get hurt because of the pace that they have to maintain to meet the goals set by Amazon.
Machinists have tried to unionize Amazon warehouses, but they haven't succeeded. Company spokeswoman Lauren Lynch says Amazon gives warehouse workers the exact same benefits as other employees, including health insurance, retirement plans, paid parental leave, and company stock.
We respect our associates' individual rights, and we have an open-door policy that encourages comments, questions, and concerns be brought directly to the management teams, including all the way up to our CEO. We firmly believe this direct connection is the most effective way to understand and respond to the needs of our workforce.
Lynch says most of the new jobs are in fulfillment centers, though they range from entry-level to engineers. The warehouse jobs are listed at $13 or $16 an hour. Greg LeRoy, who directs a nonprofit called Good Jobs First, says that's higher than minimum wage, but still not enough.
Because we are so, obsessed with taxpayer dollars, one definition that we've used is a job in which the wage and benefit package is good enough that a family of three would no longer depend on any social safety net assistance.
Amazon has the second highest turnover rate in the country, according to a 2013 PayScale survey. Still, with the unemployment rate in southern counties like Cape May around 10%, it's likely there will be high demand for these new jobs. For WHYY News, I'm Jeanette Beebe.
A husband and wife physician team from suburban Philadelphia are trying to improve the safety of medical devices after an incident where one device was deemed responsible for spreading undetected cancer. We're joined by Dr. Hooman Norchasm and his wife, Dr. Amy Reed, who say a device used in the treatment of fibroids puts women at risk of cancer. Now a report by the General Accounting Office confirms what the duo have been saying all along. Explain for people who don't know, a fibroid can be as big as a grapefruit inside a woman's body, and the treatment can be done in multiple ways. Explain what is involved in this specific way.
Fibroids are relatively common. It's estimated that as many as 4 out of 5 women will have a fibroid at some time in their life. And it's basically just an overgrowth of the soft muscle tissue in the uterus. And they can be small, or they can grow very large. And women can have symptoms from them, such as bleeding, pain, and cramping. There are many treatment options available for women, but the definitive option is to have the fibroid and or the uterus surgically removed, that being a hysterectomy. In my case, I knew I had fibroids, and they had gotten quite large. So when I went in, they described to me that the only definitive treatment was to have a hysterectomy.
But then there was the use of a device called a morcellator. And explain how that works and what happened in your case.
When you do a hysterectomy, you have to remove the uterus. An instrument called a morcellator had been introduced about 20 years ago, and it's basically like a small meat grinder that can go into these small incisions and grind up the tissues.
But what you found out is that the morcellator actually spread the cancer that was undetected before the procedure.
The morcellator basically shreds the tissue, and then surgeons would go back and try and pick up the larger pieces, but there is a village of tissue that you can't see. In my case, I had a sarcoma that was undetected, so when they morcellated that, they shredded up the cancer. And the cancer cells then were dripped throughout my peritoneal cavity.
And now you're still fighting cancer after the procedure.
Exactly. Since that time, I've had spreading to, almost everywhere.
Now, Dr. Norchasm, you've been fighting this because the FDA has lax oversight on this specific piece of equipment. You are fighting to have this procedure stopped.
Right. This particular practice is something that really was confined to gynecology. And so virtually none of my general surgery colleagues had ever heard of this power morcellator. And it just demonstrates to you how siloed gynecologists are in terms of their training and in terms of their practice from other surgeons. Because I can tell you with almost 100% certainty that no other surgeons would take a tumor with malignant potential and mince it up inside the body because it risks spreading cancer. Now, the basis for this, of course, is that a minority subset of women, less than 1%, something around 1 in 300, are ones who have the occult cancers. But of course, you know, the gynecologist, the number that they had assumed was somewhere in the 1 in 10,000 range. So that's one of the numbers that we debunked very early on. And the initial number that we came up with was 1 in 415. So out of every 415 women with symptomatic fibroid, one of them will have an occult uterine sarcoma, and if morphylated, that could potentially spread. That was the scope of the problem initially. But then we went back and we looked at how it is that this device actually had gotten onto the market without this being picked up, because, you know, very quickly it became clear that we were the first reporters of this complication to the FDA. And that really has to do with the regulatory framework that the FDA uses for all medical devices. So I think that the power morphylator actually is really a paradigm for a far greater hazard that exists in the medical device regulatory space at the FDA.
So now the General Accounting Office report is confirming everything that you've been fighting for over the years.
This GAO report is de facto evidence that literally hundreds, if not thousands, of unsuspecting women over the course of 20 years have been harmed or unreasonably died because of this regulatory failure. So it needs to be fixed.
So there is a bill that would help address this. Can you explain how that works?
Basically, it's called the Medical Device Guardians Act. It is a bill that is essentially seeking to codify a mandate of the American Medical Association's Code of Medical Ethics. And that is simply this, that if you are an expert physician and you use a device in your practice and that causes an adverse outcome, you now have a legal obligation to report this to the FDA. It seems like common sense, but the reality is that it just isn't in place. And in fact, the reason why the power morphylator hazard had remained unknown to the FDA had to do with the fact that practitioners who were, you know, on the ground seeing this problem had absolutely no legal requirements to report back to the FDA. Hospitals and manufacturers do, but the practitioner doesn't.
So where do we go from here?
In 2017, the Medical Device User Authorization Fee Act is coming up for renewal, and it's possible to actually piggyback this Guardians Act into that larger bill and hopefully get it through the Congress and the President's desk.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hooman Noorkazem and Dr. Amy Reed, for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
In the theater world, there are playwrights who script their works, and there's also improvisation, where actors create action and characters in the moment. Another approach, called devised theater, explores a middle ground, where a troupe of artists collectively shapes a performance over a series of intense rehearsals. NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas visited Fringe Arts to see the process in action.
This week, the rehearsals for Sans Everything have included a lot of give and take.
Making a proposal that these are like this at the top of the show?
Two companies, Lightning Rod Special and Strange Attractor Theater Company, are collaborating on a work of devised theater. Alice York is co-director of Lightning Rod Special.
It's an original piece created by the ensemble members. It's not one person going off and writing on their own. It's people making proposals, making ideas, suggesting characters. Each individual is responsible both for the development of their own character and for how that fits into the arc of the show and the larger story.
The end result of this collective effort, Sans Everything, is set far in the future, when people no longer need physical bodies. Some of the highly evolved intelligent beings choose to re-embody themselves and go through the human life cycle. Scott Shepard is York's fellow co-director at Lightning Rod Special.
They kind of are equipped with a lot of quote-unquote book smarts, but they have no somatic smarts. So they don't know what it's like to have hands or to feel things that are cold or to laugh or to feel emotions.
Redheads were sensitive to capsaicin and thermal pain, but for subcutaneous pain, they had a higher threshold.
And as this group is going through the human life cycle, they encounter Shakespeare's As You Like It, and it causes a huge rift in their experience of life, the introduction of performance and art and story, and all of the things that means, love, gender, sex, discord.
Sans Everything is on stage at Fringe Arts this evening through Saturday. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
The early 20th century in America was marked by big demographic shifts and a reassessment of the role of religion by many caught up in the changes. That's the focus of Princeton religion professor Judith Weisenfeld's new book, entitled New World A-Comin', Black Religion and Racial Identity During the Great Migration. Professor Weisenfeld joined Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller to give some insight on the time period.
Well, why don't we start with terms? Tell us about the variables that led to the Great Migration 100 years ago and more.
Well, this period of the early 20th century saw large numbers of Southern African Americans migrating from rural contexts to urban contexts, sometimes in the South, but also to cities in the North. The migration was spurred by economic changes and interest in broader employment, social opportunities in the North.
Was it then less a matter of what they were fleeing from and more the opportunities they were attracted to?
It was a combination of both. There were push factors, Jim Crow segregation, the racial terrorism of the Klan, and so on. There was a boll weevil infestation in the cotton crop. So these were the push factors that people were motivated to leave. The pull factors involved employment opportunities that were in northern industries and just the appeal of greater social freedom, educational opportunity, and economic opportunity. Those, of course, did not work out to the degree that, you know, the North was not the promised land. But the combination of the push factors and the pull factors produced a massive population shift.
Why was there a concomitant push-pull in terms of defining one's own narrative regarding religion?
One way to think about it has to do with the importance of the narrative of Exodus, for example, in Black Christianity in the antebellum period under slavery. So as people turn to the Bible, for example, to help them think about and make meaning of their experiences as enslaved people in the Americas, what meaning could there be to this horrible experience? Exodus provided a kind of map and a sense of being God's people, like those people in the Bible, and seeing the hope of liberation. After the end of slavery, the collapse of Reconstruction, the rise of Jim Crow, people of African descent in the U.S. were casting about for new ways to think religiously about the meaning of their individual lives and their collective experience. And we see lots of kind of theological wrestling among Black Christians. What also emerges after this, and the cities of the Great Migration, the urban North, become a real kind of incubator of new ways of thinking about that. We find people who ask really hard questions about if this is where we still are, if things are still so challenging, perhaps the Bible, perhaps Christianity, perhaps the church institutions that are connected to Christianity, perhaps that's not where we need to look.
As you mentioned, Father Divine, of course, a central role here in Philadelphia when I believe
yes.
He came here in 1942. You said several northern cities were central, including Philadelphia. Tell us more about this city's role.
We find in Philadelphia, certainly Father Divine's movement is there before he himself relocates there. So he's able to, when he moves from Harlem to Philadelphia, establish himself in Philadelphia, which was one of the major communities for the peace mission movement. The Moore Science Temple had a strong presence in Philadelphia. That movement that had been founded by a man who called himself Noble Drew Ali, who was a migrant from Virginia to Newark, and he founded a small movement there, but it became a large movement in Chicago in 1925 and then became national from there. Philadelphia had a strong community of members of the Moore Science Temple from relatively early on in the 1930s, and after Noble Drew Ali's death in 1929, one of the major figures who kind of rises to prominence is connected to Philadelphia. So it's an important arena for spreading the movement's theology.
That's Princeton religion professor Judith Weisenfeld, author of New World A-Comin', Black Religion and Radical Identity During the Great Migration, speaking with Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller. You can hear more of their conversation at newsworks.org. Finally this evening, pop quiz. Of the three states in WHYY's listening area, in which one are residents safest from break-ins, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or Delaware? According to statistics from the FBI, it's Pennsylvania. In fact, the Keystone State is one of the safest in the entire country, ranking sixth in fewest burglaries per 100,000 residents. New Jersey's right behind at number seven. However, Delaware residents should remember to lock that deadbolt. In this case, Delaware is not the first state, but number 32, coming in behind states with images of unsafe big cities like California, Illinois, and Washington, D.C. Which state had the fewest burglaries? That honor goes to New York. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.